we'd be looking at news applications, which are kind of a difficult. What are they? What the heck? How are we going to save these things? Luckily, we have four smart people here to help. Martin, you're going to be the moderator. Martin Klein, I'll let you guys take it away.
Right, thanks, Edward. So this is the panel called Kiss Your App Goodbye, and this is not about your six-pack. We're talking about data journalism, news apps. We have three spectacular presenters for you today. I'll leave it up to them individually to briefly introduce themselves. We decided for a format, or rather traditional format of 10 to 15 minutes presentation each, and then we'll open up the floor for questions and hoping for a really interactive and vivid discussion here in this session. Right, first up, Meredith, take it away.
Hi, everybody. My name is Meredith Broussard. I teach data journalism at NYU. I describe data journalism as the practice of finding stories in numbers and using numbers to tell stories. And what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about news apps, how they're disappearing, and how we can save them. So I want to start by talking about what is a news app. So a news app is not the thing that you would install on your phone. It's not the thing that you use to read the New York Times. Rather, a news app is an interactive database that is presented online that has a storytelling function. So Dollars for Docs by ProPublica is a great example of this. Dollars for Docs has years' worth of data on pharmaceutical industry payments to doctors. So what you can do is you can go in and you can look up your doctor inside Dollars for Docs and find out if they have received money from a pharmaceutical company, and if so, for what, and you can decide how much that matters to you. So if you go in and you see your doctor's name and you see that your doctor has prescribed you a particular kind of statin drug, and you see that that doctor has received $80 in educational materials from the pharmaceutical company who manufactures that statin drug, how do you feel? Thumbs up, thumbs down? Yeah, all right. So what if I told you that the doctor had received $8,000 from the pharmaceutical company who manufactures the statin drug that it prescribed to you? How do you feel? Thumbs up, thumbs down? Okay, a little more thumbs down. All right, so how you feel about the money, about your doctor, about the drug, about the relationship, is dependent on a lot of factors. And as a reporter, I can't write a story about all those factors because, you know, people have different feelings about money, and $80 is different than $8,000. And for doctors who are earning, $1 million a year, I don't really care much about $80, whereas, you know, doctors earning, you know, less than $1 million a year, if I'm curious more about it, so these things are all relative. Anyway, a news app allows the reader to put themselves into the story in a way that was not possible before. So we love news apps. I make news apps. I love news apps. And they're some of the most innovative and cutting-edge types of digital journalism that are being produced today. And I want to talk a little bit about what the news app looks like behind the scenes, and what it looks like behind the scenes inside every news organization. All right, so I've got an illustration up on the screen here. And do I have a pointer on this thing? All right, excellent, we're business. Every news organization has a kind of complicated spaghetti behind the scenes. You've got your web CMS, your web content management system, and this is connected to the web server, and as a reader who is accessing news on the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, via your phone or via your desktop, you are using your browser to connect to the web server, and that is the content is being served up by the web CMS. Now, inside the news organization, there's also another CMS, and that's the print CMS. That's the thing that's hooked up to the actual printers. Okay, the things that churn out the newspapers. This is the configuration at legacy news organizations, I should say. It's not necessarily configuration at digital news operations. And then we've also got the video CMS, which is a separate CMS, because video hosting is different than image hosting, which is different than hosting text and HTML files. So behind the scenes, we've got these three different things that are all hooked up to look like they run together. And you see this seamless, dynamically assembled web page. Now, what happened when, at the dawn of the internet era, is that news organizations have been using print CMSs for much longer than you expect, and those print CMSs generally are hooked up to automatic feeds. So organizations like EBSCO or LexisNexis, or newspapers.com, usually there's software that automatically feeds from the print CMS into the commercial archiver, and that's what goes to the library. So when you're a communications scholar and you're using your computer to access the library databases, you're hitting one of these commercial providers, and you may think that you're getting everything. You may think that you're getting everything, but in fact you're not. But you don't know what you're not getting because there's no way to figure it out. Because searching on the web server, you'll get totally different results than if you're searching in the library database. Now, this is a complication, obviously, for scholars. You can take communication scholars who are trying to do content analyses. They think that they're getting a whole chunk of everything that's been produced by this newspaper in this period of time, but they're not. Well, what's going on? Okay, so it gets even more complicated when we get to news apps. If you're not already, your head isn't already spinning. So news apps don't live inside any of these content management systems. News apps are custom-built databases. They're bespoke. So they actually can't live inside the CMS, largely because of, you know, organizational conflicts and IT issues. So they tend to live on a separate data server, which is outside of the ordinary configuration of the website. And the news apps are skinned to look like the rest of the content on the website, but they're not actually in the same place. So this has implications for crawlers, right? So if the crawler is based on the configuration of the web CMS, well, crawlers don't really handle dynamic web content very well. Well, the data server, the news app, they tend to be dynamic, right? They tend to be database driven. So it's a huge technical problem. What do we do? We don't really know. So this is what my research is about nowadays. And so I'm collaborating with Catherine Boss and with Eva Revere at NYU, and we are trying to figure out how to save news apps. So we are taking as our first step, we're taking a single case, and we're trying to figure out how to preserve a single news app. And then we're going to take those lessons and we're going to generalize. We're going to say, how can we save other news apps? So we're starting with Dollars for Docs by ProPublica. We picked that because it is iconic. There are a few examples of web projects that are really significant to data journalists. There was another project called EveryBlock a few years ago that evolved from something called Chicago Crime. So it was made by a developer named Adrian Holovaty in early part of the aughts. Adrian Holovaty built ChicagoCrime.org with a stream of data from the Chicago Police Department and the Google Maps API, which was then brand new. And so this was really groundbreaking. This was a new way of doing journalism on the web, and we're all really excited about it. It was really inspiring. Chicago Crime then evolved into something called everyblock.com. It rolled out across Chicago. It rolled out to other cities. It was national. It was successful. It was bringing together crime data, also other community data. It was a big success. It was inspirational in the news community. It was bought by MSNBC. Big success. It was bought by NBC News. And then it was shut down. And this was the first time that the data journalism community really woke up and said, hey, we have a problem here. You know, they told us the internet was forever, but that's not true. Things get shut down. So we have to actively work to preserve these artifacts. But every block is a database. It's not a series of static web pages. It's a database. And so you have to preserve databases differently. Okay. So every blog was iconic. I would argue also that the website for Black Hawk Down, which is still out there somewhere on the internet, and you can still see it, is another iconic example. And Dollars for Dogs is another really iconic example. It's the example of the site that I talk about kind of exciting interactive journalism, one of the many examples. There are a bunch of LA Times projects that people always talk about as well. So our goal is preservation. So first of all, you're going to hear later on in the lightning talk about the survey that we were doing to find out what are the news apps that are out there. And in preserving Dollars for Docs, we are looking at a tool from the world of scientific reproducibility. So there's a tool called ReproZip that was developed by our colleagues at NYU at the Center for Data Science. And we are working with them to use ReproZip in order to preserve Dollars for Docs. Now, something important about our approach is we're not going from the outside. We're not taking a web crawler approach. We're working from the inside, and we're working with ProPublica to preserve the material at its source. ReproZip is interesting because it's a tool for scientific reproducibility, and it preserves the code, the data, and the environment where the experiment was run. And so we think this is going to be very exciting for preserving news apps because news apps are databases that run inside a specific environment. They have code, they have data, and another thing we like about ReproZip is it allows us to attach metadata and then deposit the entire container into an institutional repository. So that is our project, Save News Apps. And I look forward to taking questions in a little bit. Thank you.
Okay, I'm up next. I think I can find my slides. I found them. Okay, I'm gonna make this full screen. You guys think I can do it? Should I even try? I'm gonna ask for help on the Apple hotkeys, like one of these many interesting buttons. No, not that one, Ben. We're going to give up.
We're going to get the
Hey, that's me. Okay, there's a clicker. Think the clicker's going to work? Boom, boom, boom. All right, cool. Let's roll. All right, my talk is the framework fix. I don't have much time, so I'm going to go really fast. Okay, my name is Ben. This is me. I want to clean shaven. My wife refers to this as my Bible salesman portrait. All right, sometimes I go by Pale Wire online. That's where I've been tweeting. I'm going to go fast, but you can find all the slides right here if you ever want to slow down and look at anything individually, or you can just ask me about it later. All right, so I work at the LA Times in downtown LA, and despite what you've heard, it is still standing. We're still reporting for work, and it comes out every day. It's a thing. There I work on a team called the Data Desk. We are a team of nerds in the newsroom who take data and structured information, we gather it, organize it, analyze it, use it to tell, find and tell stories, like Meredith said. That means we do analysis that makes an impact. A couple years ago, we analyzed the buildings across LA City, like the collapse and the next earthquake, a list that the government and university researchers wanted to keep secret. We ultimately pressured it for it to be published, and it was, and that resulted in LA City adopting the toughest earthquake safety rules in America. We also make apps that serve our audience, things like Meredith was describing, like, say, the Homicide Report, which is a database and blog of every person killed by another person in Los Angeles County. Over the last 15 years or so, also things like recipes that aren't quite as serious actually are kind of databases and news apps in their own ways when you think about it, and this is a site at recipes.latimes.com where we publish many of those recipes. Also, we use our software development skills to make internal tools to help the newsroom do a better job. For instance, we do a lot of long-form storytelling where we want to make big, fancy pages like the infamous snowfall. As you scroll, things dance, magic things happen, videos play, etc.
Guess what? Those print CMSs Meredith was talking about can't do any of that. So we do all that custom web development basically outside of the core CMS in something what you might call or might not call a news app. We also do internal tools to help make the development of tools inside the print CMS easier as well. And then we just use our nerdy skills to try and do crazy stuff, like say have robots write the news for us so we can go home and drink beer, or make VR apps so that you can visit Mars. All right, and how do we do all that? That means we write code. So while I went to journalism school, everybody I worked with went to journalism school, we all consider ourselves journalists, and we work in the newsroom, we spend most of our day writing computer code. This is a bit of Python, and a lot of those that code is written using the tools of web development. I've used those same skills in my own work outside of work to make an archive called Past Pages, which is kind of a news homepage archive. The whole thing's open source, and it's been this weird journey that's brought me into this world as well. All right. And anytime I start talking to other journalists or people about the sort of nerdy things we do, a question I often get is, how'd you learn all that, Ben? How'd you learn to become a computer programmer? It sounds so hard, right? It's this really difficult skill that takes years to learn, blah, blah, blah. Can I tell you a secret? You guys ready? You won't tell? I'm a faker. I'm not a very good computer programmer. Most of us aren't. And in fact, most web developers aren't either, even the professional ones, right? And we're able to fake and get pretty far because we lean on each other and we use a system of tools that we like to call frameworks. And a framework is basically a collection of open source tools that manage the elements of web development and taken together allow us to sort of have a tool belt of shortcuts and things that do stuff for us. And almost every programming language has one or more frameworks that make it easier for someone to build a website without having to know how to do every little bit that goes into building that website, right? So we use one called Django down there in the corner, which is a Python framework. These are all goofy web frameworks different people use. I have Dollars for Docs, which Meredith showed, I think was probably built with the one there called Rails, which is in a different programming language called Ruby. And they're just kind of kits, software development kits you can download and start making stuff with, right? And they do a lot of things for you. A lot of things you might not know how to do right now, they make really easy, and they're kind of built in there. And you can kind of lean on them like magic. They do things like make sure your site doesn't get hacked by handling a lot of basic security tasks. And, you don't know how to write SQL to interact with the database directly? Oh, the framework's going to let you write a little Python, and it's going to sort all that out for you. Hey, you don't know how to translate your website into Spanish or a different language? Don't worry, there's a system inside Django and Rails that can do most of that for you. And, you want to figure out how you're going to deploy all that software code onto a server and look it up so people can actually see it on the internet, which sounds like really complicated and hard. Guess what? These frameworks do most of that for you, and you just need to read some documentation and screw around with it till it works, right? Because there's hundreds of other developers who've decided to collaborate to build this software to make it all easier. But if you were to look at this list, you might see something missing, right? Anybody got a guess what wasn't on this list? Archiving! Right? So these tools that all these developers lean on to help them do all this stuff they don't know how to do very well, and to collaborate together to get all that done independently, doesn't take on and tackle, none of them really, take on and tackle this key problem that we're all here to talk about how to solve. Right? And so it came up just in my own life the other day, just in my random Twitter feed, where I now follow all sorts of weird web developers who I never thought I would years ago. I just see retweeted across my feed some person I don't know who's like, man, I've got to get rid of some app that I'm responsible for or looking at, and I have no goddamn clue how. Right? And then one of their friends rebroadcasted it out and said, hey, man, who writes in React? Anyone know what React is? This is the cool hipster framework now that Facebook has put out in JavaScript that supposedly can do everything. And so all us programmers should stop doing what we're doing and use this framework because it's so much better than the other ones. Right? But guess what? It doesn't do any archiving. Right? And so now the React people are on Twitter buzzing around out there trying to figure out how the hell to shut it down. And if you went and read the thread, you'd see nobody had the goddamn clue. Right? And to me, the message of like my little talk is that like this little conversation and those frameworks where I've shown you, that's where the web developers are. Right? That's where they're at. That's where they're working. That's where they're solving problems. And if we want to have them solve the problem we're talking about, we need to get solutions into that venue, into those frameworks, those open source systems that they're using to solve the problems. So just for example, the one I use is called Django. You know, you don't have to use it. It's the one I like, okay? It's in the Python programming language. It was created at a Kansas newspaper, actually, by Adrian Holvati and his coworkers there at the Lawrence Journal World. It is used by Instagram, Pinterest, Mozilla, Discuss, WikiLeaks, and our LA Times apps, right? So all of these things, the Instagram you were on this morning is running Django in this framework and using those shortcuts to solve problems, right? And it's the product of thousands of developers around the world building these tools to build websites, right? And it has a modular design for plugins that allows really anyone to come up with a third-party thing that can slide into it. And then those things ultimately, through committee process and the whole open source thing, become integrated in the core thing itself, right? And so Memento is something we hear about a lot here at this conference, right? Which is a new web protocol so that in addition to requesting a URL, you can also request a time, and then you get the URL not just as it is now, but as it was at the time that you're requested, right? So that system is designed by Martin and his colleagues at Los Alamos and elsewhere to help solve that problem, and it's a standard that's out there, right? So Django, again, has a modular design for plugins. So you can make, as we did, and I think showed at the previous conference, a plugin for Django, right, that says we're going to make it Memento compliant, possible to integrate it into Django without a whole lot of hassle. So, you know, this is how you might make a time map if you're in Memento, and you just write maybe 10, 15 lines of Python, plug in your database, and boom, out comes the time map. And that system can then be installed into a Django framework, and with a small amount of training or documentation, can be plugged in with just like one line of code, and then writing something like this, and you're done. Right, and you can find that on there, run like that. Another example would be a WordPress plugin for Memento as well, which is another thing we've been working on with RJI. So I just go to the WordPress plugin store, I install the Memento plugin, I click it, boom, I've got Memento installed in my system. Right, and so to me, this type of approach to solving the problem integrates our archiving tools into these popular frameworks. They're not hard to install, and the sites themselves can become self-archiving and help make the whole system and network stronger so that we don't have to clean up the messes after they've been published, right? You know, the problem is, though, that they're just obscure packages that, you know, I'm writing or someone else is writing that are lost out there in the sea of the internet. Developers have to know it's a problem. They have to seek it out. They have to install it, figure it out, blah, blah, blah. And the frameworks are strongest when these best practices we're talking about are actually just integrated into the system and are the sensible defaults that you're just sort of using without even really knowing it. And so to me, it's like this approach, I think, is really powerful and has a lot of potential, but we have way more we need to do if we're ever going to pull it out. And I think part of that is bringing the people who organize and run these frameworks into these discussions and ourselves even lobbying within the open source politics of those networks for them to put archiving on the same footing as security, internationalization, handling web requests, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So that's my little spiel. The end. The slides are here. If you want them, you probably heard enough. And I'm done.
I'm a librarian. I work at Stanford. I am a subject specialist and a collection development librarian. And I serve a couple of departments on campus, mainly communication and journalism, sociology, anthropology, and I have some small funds that help cover feminist studies and Lusophone Africa. But this story is really about meeting with faculty in communication and journalism departments. So we have a new computational journalism track master's program at Stanford that's been developed over a few years, but the lab is new. And in meeting with the faculty there, the conversation went like this. Well, we need data for our classes, for our students, for our projects, for our stories, to tell stories, and what our dream would be is to have data sets from, you know, we make FOIA requests all the time to local governments, state governments, federal government agencies, and we get this data, and then where does it go? How can we bring it together and make it into something like a big local repository? So a lot of what I'm talking about, too. I just wanted to mention Christine Borgman's book, Big Data, Little Data, No Data, because it is really influential in terms of the way we think about the data life cycle and how we manage this kind of request that we might get from a faculty member or students or other researchers who are working on their own stories. Mm-hmm. So, two of the main things in trying to provide this to serve this community that are really high priority for me is the preservation and the sharing. So these images are just to remind me to mention that as really core to my goal and what we're working on. So at Stanford, we have a relatively new institutional repository, but the issue there is that you have to be a member of the community to deposit there. And so we were thinking, myself, I say we because I'm not working by myself. I have the digital library services team and also other librarians in social sciences who I talk to, and mainly Chris Kasanovich, who is a government information librarian who comes from UCLA, in fact. And we are talking about government data that can be somehow collected and archived in a way that brings the pieces together for new stories, new research, and in a reusable, shareable way. So those are important things to point out, because how we can archive a lot of data, but if you can't figure out how it was collected or how it was used or what were the scripts that were written to analyze it, then it's not as useful as it could be, or it's not, you can't compare it to other data sets if it's not normalized in some way. And so we are not proposing a way of cleaning the data, but we're hoping that we can work with people who actually do that. And Ben is actually someone that I met him at the NICAR conference, and he was doing a hackathon and helping to clean up some government information. And so that was my first foray into helping with that. And actually, Meredith was there too. So that's an important step, and it's something that is a complexity of the whole idea of what we want to do. But what we want to do is to leverage the Stanford Digital Repository, which is built on Hydra, which is open source code, and is currently they're developing Hydra in a box, which is open repository system for others to use. And what we're thinking is to leverage that technology that's already in place, that code that's in place, and the expertise that people have already been mentioning at this conference. In fact, I've learned so many new pieces that we could somehow incorporate into this idea of having a way to have these repositories share their information with each other in terms of access. So getting the data, cleaning the data, making sure it's usable, but then how do people find it? So that's another step. And so the Hydra in a box should have an API attached to it. And then this is an earlier drawing of our idea of this repository, and we're calling it Builder because that's what that's kind of the core reason why I started getting into this, was just that big local data. So local data that's collected from your town, city government, county government, state government, coming together and making something bigger, so small data sets, but actually becoming a big local data repository. So some of the things that I spoke about here is Hydra, and that's one of the areas that we're looking into, and we are looking for grant opportunities and collaboratory partnerships of others who are like-minded and interested in this. And One of the things that I was also looking at is in social sciences, we have ICFSR, and they have a long history of already handling tricky data sets and cleaning data sets and the membership kind of side to things like the sustainability issues that come up when you're thinking about something on this kind of scale. And then also, really, again, just going back to the preservation layer, so multiple copies keep things safe, so locks, lots of copies keep stuff safe, is a system that is used at Stanford and is open for use. And it, even though I'm hearing things about cloud-based opportunities, and this is kind of like that, except you know, different, but it's the distributed aspect of preservation, because in talking to journalists who also have all these wonderful data sets, some of them may be shareable, some of them may not for ethical reasons, right? So we understand that. But for things that are open data, that's public data that we can leverage and use, we want it to be preserved, not just in GitHub. So at NICAR, I talked to a lot of journalists, and like, oh yes, I've got it in GitHub. I was like, yes, that's great, but is it preserved? Will it stay there forever? How long will it be there? Well, sometimes I have to take it down because I don't have enough space. So then we're thinking, well, maybe we as collection development librarians, you know, we should go into GitHub and try to scrape what we can from there. And so that's kind of a new strategy that we're thinking through to see what we could do in terms of collection development. So it's not... The scope is really like different from looking at title by title, but more like data set by data set and how it might fit into a theme. So there are some, obviously, repositories that do some of this already. ICFSR is one. The NICAR data library is another. You have to be a member for both of those things. Newsrooms have open source software called Panda that needs continued some sort of sustainability model, but that's a closed network, obviously, for individual newsrooms. What could we, if we could partner with Panda administrators, maybe we could retrieve some of the data that's sitting in those databases and make those open and searchable through an access point interface. So CRADA is the government. It's used a lot by government agencies, but it just doesn't have that preservation layer. And a lot of times the data gets refreshed, and so then we lose the earlier versions of things, which could matter depending on what your research is looking for and looking at. And then in terms of working with apps, we want to have the data there that is used in a particular app so that it could be reproduced in 100, 150 years. So I wanted to take a little step back and talk a little bit about metadata really quickly and some of the standards, and I just want to have some shout-outs here. But one that I think is interesting and is used in social sciences is the DDI Alliance standards, and it can be mapped to RDF, which would really create a lot more access points in terms of accessing the data sets and maybe sharing across repositories. So if we have institutional repositories using a standardized metadata or some kind of way of so that we can find out what each other has, then that would open up more access points for future researchers. Thank you.
Much. So this is the time where we would like to open up the floor for questions. And I may be the one running around with a microphone.
I hope this isn't a naive question, but these institutions like GitHub and, or for that matter, Facebook with Instagram, and there's companies and NGOs and governments that, besides actual engineers, who could build into their DNA preserving things. And, you know, if they feel it isn't in their commercial interest, maybe we offer get grant money from the library. I'm just trying to figure out to what extent the existing nonprofit government and commercial institutions, to our knowledge, are integrating archiving into their thinking to our knowledge. Anyone who knows the answers to any of those institutions?
I don't know the answer, but I do have some commentary on that. when it comes to copyright and proprietary data and information, you know, obviously that's always very complex and tricky. But it is heartening in some. I have an example with the CRL libraries negotiating with Newsbank to be able to archive international news. Correct me if I'm wrong, but international news at a certain point, it will be something that CRL will be able to preserve. So I don't want to conflate archiving with preserving, right? And making that available to membership of CRL. So that's one avenue. But that is part of the problem. Part of the problem is that there is sustainability issues. I mean, it's expensive to preserve and archive content, but then there's also ways of making money off of content, and we need to respect that when we can, but also we don't want to lose the content, and that's the problem, you know, that we're discussing here at this event. And it's really fascinating to me just to try to tease out where we can make those kinds of agreements with the news organizations that, oh, at a certain point, we'll take that.
I think it's also important to note that there's only so much that the machines can do. This is a people issue. And when we put stuff onto GitHub, it is made inside the framework that Ben mentioned. It's produced by organizations. Organizations have politics, have their own internal requirements, so it's not really as easy as just like pushing a button. Like it's a complex web of technology and social issues.
I had a question when you talked about the content management systems that brought to mind the last talk and Peter's discussion of putting this stuff in tin cases for years. I'm wondering, in this digital environment, what's the equivalent of that archive of material that's produced but never sees the light of day, and where does it reside, you know?
It's called people's hard drives. I have a pile in my office of old computers, and then I have boxes of and they're archival boxes. They're filled with archival sleeves, and I print out everything that I write and I put it in there. For my digital projects, I archive them onto some sort of medium and like throw them in a drawer somewhere. I do screenshots, but sometimes when I have my act together, I do video casts. But we're much less, people are much less organized than you imagine.
But that's actually a case where the tools of web development, particularly version control software, if you're familiar with that, can actually help us help ourselves be more organized and get work done, but also archive our work along the way. You know, Dan had mentioned GitHub. I don't know if you're familiar with Git, which is an example of one of these version control tools, where essentially as you're editing your code, building your news app, you're logging and saving every change to the code as it goes, which is then published along with the code itself. That tool actually was created so multiple people could write code at the same time without screwing it up and like stepping on each other, but it also has kind of archival built into it at the same time. So that's a way where kind of a smart software that makes everybody's lives easier also makes archiving easier. And that's part of the reason why for almost all of our data analysis projects we do now on our team, all the code's going into version control as we're writing it.
This is a question partly in response to Regina's answer to the, one of the earlier questions. What's more important to a library or someone who wants to preserve cultural heritage into the indefinite future, is it more important to obey copyright or rights laws as they currently exist, or is it more important to, by whatever means, preserve data, cultural heritage, for hundreds of years? And I know there's not a yes or no or right or wrong answer to it.
Right. Well, for me, it's equally important because definitely the content creators deserve to be paid or to maintain the copyright control over their work. But at the same time, we don't want to lose access to it, or we don't want to not have access to copyright. So, you know, it's always, it's, so the new, you know, Creative Commons copyright systems are really helpful for people like us in libraries. And also there are ways to do that with data, too, to assign a Creative Commons type license to a data. And there's terms of, you know, the terms of use on data, too, we have to, like, be attentive to and address as well. I would say sometimes there's ways we could maybe archive something now and embargo it for later. And that might be a safe way of having it sitting with us, and then have some way of triggering when we can open that up for more access.
So let me be a little bit more blunt. If you had a choice between archiving something and perhaps doing it on the border, maybe a little bit across the border of what's legal and what's not, or not doing it, which would you choose, and why? And not just for Virginia, but for Ben and Meredith as well.
You have my permission, Frederick.
Ask her.
Take it, man. I need help saving this stuff.
Well, I mean, especially with the news, it has a, you know, it's a civic responsibility of reporting the news. So there is that public, it's in the public domain in a sense.
I would ask myself, what would Peter Arnett do? I think that.
Well, I personally also think that the survival of like an entire generation of journalists' career of work is basically at stake, and in the current status quo, it will largely disappear. And so, in my view, we are essentially at war footing. And so, I think that the extraordinary times that we're in call for extraordinary measures. And so, Frederick, I welcome your creativity.
Maybe one more, Matt?
So, kind of echoing the question that was just asked, but maybe turning it on its head a little bit, my question is, what shouldn't we be preserving, particularly in the context of what you're talking about with code and apps being developed? And I understand Ben's point, the point about preserving as much of journalism as we can, but today, we replicate data so quickly, and a great example came up in the conversations we were having yesterday, where people are taking photos, and you press a button on the camera, and in a minute you have 100 photos that have been taken. Code's very much the same way if you think about what happens on GitHub and how quickly code is replicated and forked and modified. How much of that do we preserve, and what don't we keep?
I'm primarily interested in keeping the published work, which to me is obviously the highest priority. And like as I just said, I feel that that itself is so endangered that like we need to save that, and then we can worry about the notes and all the many thousands of lines of bad code that I wrote along the way. So to me, it almost feels like a luxury to kind of worry about some of those things. But specifically, like in my day-to-day, what do I actually worry about saving that I shouldn't save? To be honest, it's things that might have legal repercussions, particularly on anonymous sources and that sort of thing. That's the stuff I actually kind of worry about. And there actually are sort of anti-data retention policies at a number of news outlets to try to solve for this problem, where, say, emails are purged after a certain number of days and that sort of thing. Notes. Our lawyer actually advises us not to keep our notes for that reason.
I've heard that opinion a lot. I would agree with Ben that the published work is published work by organizations that are recognized as journalism organizations. Like, that's where I would put the priority. I know there's a debate about citizen journalism and what's the value of it. Like, we could debate that endlessly, but you know, if we're going to get anything done, like, let's focus on the journalism outlet.
Let's keep going for a little bit. We got to set something up. So,
another question there.
I particularly like Ben's comments, having looked at many governmental websites and even small presses and small journalism outlets. 9 times out of 10, they're using WordPress because it's simple, it's easy, and it's cheap. But if, you know, small snippets of code can be built in and put into the core of those mm-hmm. massive CMS projects, archiving would be way, way easier. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone, to your knowledge, working on putting those things into the core of those major CMSs like, you know, Drupal, WordPress?
I think there definitely are things around the edges, and like things like the Jetpack plugin has come up, which already exists in WordPress, which I think does help the Internet Archive do its work. I think that there are a lot of things to do this. I just think there needs to be more of it. You know, so
Ben, you should plug.
Yeah, so for instance, I plugged it quickly in the talk. We have a first generation release of a WordPress plugin for Memento, which will implement in your WordPress blog. It will publish all the previous revisions of all your live blog posts, which might be scary for some people, but I think it's really important and will allow Memento to navigate back to those. Definitely need some testing and work, so if anyone's interested in testing out Memento on their WordPress site, I would love to make that happen. But to me, you know, one thing I learned about in this world, because I've learned so much coming to these conferences because I didn't know anything about this stuff, really, was about something like locks, which I still don't know a lot about, which seems like a really cool thing. Is there, let's say, a WordPress plugin where I could install and just every time we save or nightly be, like, shipping all my stuff to locks and all I have to do is, like, sign in with my locks account, like in my little WordPress admin, and then it's just shit. Does that exist?
No.
Could that exist?
Could somebody do that?
Surely somebody's built something like that for Dropbox.
It exists, doesn't it?
It's a paid service. That's what it is.
Well, could they make the plugin and then sell it?
So we ship all our Archivist data straight into locks, but that's because it's only the people that are using locks already.
And is that shipping process like easy? Is it hard?
Yeah.
It's easy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They have good data handshakes and ingest functionality.
Could they sell it to, would it be good for their business to be able to sell it to WordPress users?
That's a hard one. I'm not going to speak to locks.
Oh, I'm just curious.
There's
a couple of them running locks.
Yeah. I've been running a locks network since 2004. So, I mean, the locks-based infrastructure makes a lot of sense, and there have actually been conversations about trying to make that something that you could just run on your computers, because there's no reason. I mean, the concept is you get 7 copies within a locks network of each piece of data, and then those copies are constantly checking in with one another.
Do you run the whole network yourself, though?
We've got 60 institutions that internationally that are part of a cooperative that's called the Meta Archive Cooperative. And those 60 institutions partner and run the infrastructure. About 24 of them are running the infrastructure, and the copies are sent around that international infrastructure.
That's really cool. And yeah. Like, to me, I think there's something called WordPress VIP.
Right.
You know what this is? So this is a hosted service WordPress sells to professional media outlets to basically run the WordPress for them. And they have a restricted list of plugins and things you could use because they don't want to deal with all the random crap people like me make. Right? But theoretically, if you could make a deal with WordPress VIP to get them to certify like a locks plugin that could go into that thing, you could rapidly turn on a bunch of big publishers and have like everything going in. Just,
right.
I don't know if this is a great idea, but it's an idea.
It's an idea. Let's talk. Some of the things that are happening.
But I think you could go down the list of like all the different things we want people to do and say, could any of these fit with this style of approach? You know?
That's an important question.
I'm an archivist, so I just wanted to follow up with a comment on your statement, which really kind of sense, about the LA Times, what did you call it, anti-retention policy.
Yeah.
There's been, especially on all the little piece of paper out front, you know, questions like, what should be retained? Well, the most common answer is everything possible. I just want to note that the archive bibs or the records, it's actually known as records management. It's absolutely standard that any organization, especially an organization that might be prone to lawsuits, has records management, universities, et cetera. I've always been told by lawyers, don't save your drafts, don't save anything but what's on the list to be retained. It's really kind of a standard piece of good business. Thanks to Peter Arnett of the world that get a lot of the really great stuff publications.
No, I agree with you. Actually, those record retention schedules, which sound like really boring documents that your local government might keep on what those rules are, believe it or not, if you go to an investigative journalist's training session, they will actually teach you to search for those and find them, because then you know what records the government has, and you can go and file requests for them. It's like a little secret roadmap for us.
Indeed.
One more question? This is such a good You're having such a good time. No?
You're running that far behind.
Well, let's thank our panelists. Okay, just a little bit of housekeeping before we go to lunch.